Chapter 52. Resolved to turn things around. Every story about Africa hinges on deception. From Egypt to Mali to Diego Garcia, subterfuge and denial are the keys to the American Empire's policies. It is as ruthless as any in history. It has enslaved more people, and its policies and actions have resulted in more deaths than those under the imperial regimes of Rome, Spain, Portugal, France, England, and Holland, or at the hands of Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler. And yet its crimes go almost unnoticed, disguised in the robes of eloquent rhetoric. Our educational systems and media actively participate in this conspiracy of lies. So, while Asia teaches us about the pitfalls of IMF and World Bank policies, Latin America lights the way toward democracy, and the Middle East exposes the extent to which neocolonialism has failed, Africa serves up what may turn out to be the most important lesson of all. Facing west toward America, Africa cups her hands around her mouth, where the Niger Delta joins the Bay of Guinea, and shouts out, "Be aware, be alert and diligent, take action." Africa is a fitting topic to close out the parts of this book that deal with the history of the modern empire, and to launch ourselves into a plan for turning it all around. More than anywhere else, Africa highlights the urgency. She is the dead canary in the mine. The mine is a death trap. We need to save ourselves, and we need to pave a way for our children to survive in a sustainable and stable world. To do so, we must listen to Africa. It is imperative that we open our ears to that voice screaming at us from across the Atlantic. "You live on a small planet," it says, "in a tiny community. To save your kids, you must also help me save mine. They are one and the same. We are family." Africa tells us that enriching Indiana farmers while impoverishing those in Mali will no longer work. It may have once, for those in Indiana, but not anymore. The same can be said for so many things that seem to make our lives convenient. The days of national interest are gone. The success of future generations rests on global interests, for the entire human community, in fact, the community of all living things. We are one people, and we are one planet. There is no room in this family for an Idi Amin, the butcher of Uganda, or for Savimbi of Angola, Mobutu and Kabila of the Congo, Abacha and Obasanjo of Nigeria, or Doe of Liberia, any more than there is for Hitler of Germany. And there can be no tolerance for oil spills in Nigeria, any more than in California, or slaves in Sudan, any more than on Virginia plantations. This message is slowly reaching across the world. Africa brings all the issues together. It is, in a way, the last frontier of unabashed exploitation, and it receives that dubious honor because we have allowed ourselves to be drugged into a stupor of self-deception. We succumb to television ads hawking cheap diamonds and gold. We brag about declining prices for laptops and cell phones. We waste gasoline and complain when the prices rise. We sweep the faces of diamond and gold miners and children poisoned by oil spills under the rug of materialistic greed. We forget that our own children will inherit that rug. They will be called upon to replace it. They will have to clean up the terrible messes we leave behind. Africa cups her hands and shouts to us. It is indeed time to change. Fortunately, we have all the tools we need to transform this world we created. Together, we can lift up that carpet, remove the messes, and quite literally, clean out the house we are about to hand over to our children. Part 5. Changing the World. Chapter 53. Four Essential Questions. On October 17, 2006, my alarm clock woke me up very early at my home in western Massachusetts. I had to catch a morning flight to San Francisco, where I was scheduled to speak at a fundraising event for Rainforest Action Network, RAN, a nonprofit organization that has convinced some of the world's most powerful corporations to change their policies toward cutting trees. I rolled out of bed, stumbled down the stairs, and filled the kettle with water for coffee. I glanced through the small window above the sink at the sun as it rose over the distant mountains. The dawning of a magnificent New England autumn day, one of the most brilliant I had ever witnessed. I set the kettle on the stove and, shaking off my drowsiness, ambled into the dining room and peered through the larger window there, across the rolling fields, at those vibrant mountains, the crimson sun, and the fiery foliage. A movement on a frost-covered knoll caught my eye. A flock of wild turkeys picked their way along the ridge. There must have been 100 of them. Their silhouettes jerked forward slowly, oddly, almost unnaturally, like cartoon parodies of prehistoric birds. I checked the clock on the bookcase and, aware that I had dallied too long, headed for the shower. As I passed the radio, I flicked it on to the local NPR station. Adjusting the water temperature, I thought about the speech I would give at the RAN event. I wanted to emphasize a point the organization's chairman, Jim Gollin, often makes, that we must work with the corporations, not against them, that the goal is not to end capitalism, but to hold it to a higher standard. Then suddenly the words of the radio announcer caught my attention. "Within less than 100 years," she said, "all the maple trees and the fall foliage will be gone from Massachusetts. According to a recent scientific study, global warming will make our climate here similar to North Carolina's. So," she sighed, "enjoy this year's display. We may not have many more like it." I stood there for a moment staring through the bathroom window. Outside, the old red maple next to the house bowed in the wind, its branches scraping against the wall. The familiar sound now seemed foreboding, a death rattle. I felt absolutely devastated. Later that day, while flying across the country, I kept thinking about the possibility that the New England fall would be relegated to history. I realized that the demise of autumnal foliage was not a possibility. It was a scientifically predictable occurrence. For the first time, I could truly empathize with Eskimos as they silently watched the Arctic ice melting, and those Himalayan nomads I had met in Tibet who bemoaned the retreat of their glaciers. For years, I had accepted the concept of global warming intellectually, but the idea that fall foliage, something I had grown up with, a symbol of my favorite time of year, was on the extinction list, hit me hard. Then I had another thought. Scientifically predictable occurrences do not need to happen, at least not the ones that are caused by us humans. We can stop them. Something I had said many times during my speeches came back to me, that to change the world, we need to change the corporatocracy. We must stop allowing those few men to continue shaping our planet's destiny. We must halt their attack on the ice caps, glaciers, autumn spectacles, on our progeny. Looking down through an airplane window at the United States of America, a land that generations of my ancestors toiled and fought for, I was struck by the fact that all the stories of EHMs and jackals in Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa are just that, stories. They may evoke pride, anger, joy, or sadness, but in the end, they are simply stories about our past, unless we choose to turn them into something more important, unless they become lessons that motivate us to take action. That day was pivotal for me. I had committed to writing a book that would inspire people to change the world. This book. I had completed drafts of all the sections except this final one, the crucial part. Up until that moment, my efforts had been impeded by doubt. I had a good idea of what I wanted to say, but not of the manner for expressing it. How, I asked myself, do you convince men and women who live comfortably to change a system that provides their comforts, even when they know about EHMs and jackals, when they understand that attached to their comforts are terrible price tags? Where do you find words to empower them to stand up to a force like the corporatocracy? How do you inspire them to take actions that will bend the corporations to the will of the people? That day, As I flew from the east to the west coast, reading articles and manuscripts I had brought with me, I realized that these are not new questions. Similar ones have been asked throughout history by everyone who has stood against oppression and for justice. Over the next few days, meeting with old friends and making new ones among the people who support RAN and its sister organizations, I came to understand that the key to answering those questions can be provided by the answers to four others. The first question we must address deals with optimism, the possibility of achieving our goal. Are we in a position where we can actually hope to affect change? Assuming we become convinced that there are reasons for optimism, we move to the next question. Are we certain that we want change? The stories about EHMs, jackals, and suffering around the globe strike raw nerves. But now we demand absolute proof that our grievances justify the efforts change will demand. Third, is there a unifying principle that will validate our efforts? We look to ascertain that we are not merely seeking to impose our moral, religious, or philosophical values on others, but instead are intent on creating something of true and lasting universal benefit. And finally, what can we each do? You and I personally need to evaluate our talents and passions. What are our individual options and desires? How do they fit into the bigger picture? In the following chapters, we will explore these questions in depth. We will rely on real-world responses, both historic and current, to answer them. We will talk with today's pioneers, men and women who themselves have asked these same questions, arrived at answers, and now are taking actions that will help each of us make our own decisions. We will examine approaches that have worked in the past and ones that are successful today. At times like these, it is important to be philosophical and to investigate the ethical implications of what we do. However, it is essential that we also apply ourselves in down-to-earth ways. Ones that will result in concrete and lasting change. Chapter 54. Change is possible. We have to be convinced that change is possible in order to make commitments to taking action and risks. Do we have grounds for optimism? I have mentioned the American Revolution a number of times in these pages. It is not a casual comparison. There are many parallels between the situation we find ourselves in today, living under the misguided hand of the corporatocracy, and the challenges faced by those early settlers. Just as then, now there is a gathering storm of conviction toward changing the corporatocracy. Yet the American Revolution could not happen until the colonists persuaded themselves that victory was possible. British subjects first saw that the empire was vulnerable in 1755 during the French and Indian War at the Battle of Monongahela, Battle of the Wilderness. George Washington, serving under British General Edward Braddock, personally witnessed one of the worst defeats in English history. Its impact on him was enormous. Braddock was killed, Washington emerged a hero, and the colonies had a new respect for their homegrown leaders, as well as a diminished regard for an army that, until then, had been considered invincible. However, in addition to Tories loyal to England, large numbers of Americans deferred from making any decision. Then, during the Revolution, at the Battle of Bunker Hill in 1775, American forces outfought the British in a ferocious pitched battle. Although the Americans ran out of powder, and the British claimed victory, nearly half the English forces lay dead or wounded. The colonists were elevated to new levels of confidence. General Washington's crossing of the Delaware on Christmas night, 1776, and his spectacular defeat of the feared Hessian mercenaries at Trenton the following day, convinced approximately 8,000 new recruits to join the Continental Army. Less than a year later, the colonial victory at Saratoga established American superiority on the battlefield, and convinced the British that their own self-interests might best be served by accepting change. It was a decisive turning point that swayed the French into becoming American allies. My personal equivalent of Monongahela happened during the last years of the 90s and the beginning ones of the new millennium, when I led a number of dream change trips deep into the Amazon. Every time I flew across the jungle, I witnessed more devastation. I was constantly reminded by the shuar that this was a sign of failure, of a lack of long-term awareness, and an indication that the corporatocracy was fallible, like the British during the French and Indian War. I came to understand that a change of course was not merely something to be desired. It is a prerequisite for the survival of our species. We learn from history that a collapsed empire leads to chaos, wars, and a new empire. In the modern context, the chaos and wars are likely to cause the annihilation of life as we know it. For me, it took the South American jungles to bring this home. I came away knowing that we simply have to find an alternative. But, I asked myself, is it possible? I needed proof. In addition to the Amazon trips, I was also teaching workshops to help executives to find creative approaches for solving problems. My students represented a cross-section of the world's most powerful companies: Exxon, General Motors, Ford, Harley-Davidson, Shell, Nike, Hewlett-Packard, even the World Bank. Several books and films popular at that time pointed out that the corporation enjoys the same rights as a living person under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. This concept was upheld in 1886 by the Supreme Court in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company, and has been a fact of law ever since. I emphasized to those executives that the corporation should also be required to accept the same responsibilities as those expected of a person. It should be a good citizen, an honorable, ethical member of the community. In the case of international corporations, that community has to be defined as the world. In actual practice, corporations are the opposite of good citizens. They bribe politicians to write laws that cheat society on a mammoth scale, most significantly by allowing them to avoid paying many of the very real costs incurred in conducting their businesses. What economists refer to as externalities are left out of pricing calculations. These include the social and environmental costs of destruction of valuable resources, pollution, the burdens on society of workers who become injured or ill and receive little or no health care, the indirect funding received when companies are permitted to market hazardous products, dump wastes into oceans and rivers, pay employees less than a living wage, provide substandard working conditions, and extract natural resources from public lands at less than market prices. Furthermore, most corporations are dependent on public subsidies, exemptions, massive advertising and lobbying campaigns, and complex transportation and communication systems that are underwritten by taxpayers. Their executives receive inflated salaries, perks, and golden retirement parachutes, which are written off as tax deductions. Under proper accounting, all these externalities would be factored into the costs of products. Those goods and services that are inherently clean would also be the cheapest. Consumers would pay a premium for products that strain the environment and society. The price would include funds for correcting the damage. In a truly free market economy, these very real costs would be internalized, included. But they are not. Why? Because accounting firms are not obligated to enforce sound accounting principles. They only need to adhere to those required by the laws, which are written by politicians who are dependent on the corporatocracy. Modern corporations have all the rights of individuals, but none of the responsibilities. In fact, they are licensed to steal. From an economic standpoint, there is simply no other word for it. They plunder the poor and future generations in order to further enrich the wealthy. As I conducted workshops and thought more on these matters, I realized that it is one thing to understand that we must insist on fundamental changes in our corporations, and it is quite another thing to convince people that we can make it happen. What are the contemporary equivalents of Bunker Hill, Trenton, and Saratoga? Where are the leverage points that give us hope? I found the answer in a packet of magazine articles I took with me to read on the flight to San Francisco that October day when I learned that New England's fall foliage is threatened with extinction. It was a pivotal day for many reasons.